Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Fiona Cork. She's an Australian actor, wildlife campaigner, and activist. For 12 years, she's volunteered as vice president for the Australian Society for Kangaroos, raising awareness of the beauty and also the cruel fate of kangaroo slaughter for damage mitigation by farmers and government departments in the commercial kangaroo industry for their meat and skins. In 2007, Fiona co-founded the Macedon Ranges Wildlife Network, where she lives. The network is actively involved in wildlife rescue, wildlife care and rehabilitation, and raises awareness of the risks and threats wildlife faces from human interaction and imminent development. Today, we talk about wildlife safe certification. So can you talk just briefly about your own history and then tell us what wildlife safe certification is?
Absolutely, Derek. Thank you for having me on the show again. You probably covered a lot of it in the intro nutshell, but I guess all that I've done up to this point has led me to this new certification label, Wildlife Safe. So it's a new Australian certification trademark, and it's registered with the ACCC, which is a third-party body, and that's the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. So the certification label and it's got a logo that will appear on goods. So this is for consumers to easily identify any products that have not had any Australian wildlife killed in the process for those goods or produce to be grown or for that service to be delivered. When I say service, as well as the certification label is very broad, it actually covers 10 classes of classifications altogether. So it covers nearly all food groups, drinks, beverages, including alcoholic beverages. We also cover some holiday accommodation and golf courses because up to this point in all the work that I've done trying to save wildlife, we've realised that there's a lot of killing wildlife that goes on in holiday resorts that rely on tourism based on the wildlife at their resorts, yet they have been found out under FOI to be killing all sorts of wildlife, including kangaroos, wallabies and cockatoos, and also golf clubs, as I spoke the last time I was on the show, Derek, about how many golf clubs and sporting associations target parrots, particularly little corellas and long-billed corellas, for damage to golf links, tennis courts. We've managed to draw the certification label to cover holiday accommodation and golf courses, which means a holiday resort can become wildlife safe, which ensures the public that no wildlife has been killed, same with sporting clubs and associations. So that's the services that we cover. So going back to food, nearly all food that's grown in Australia has animals killed for it, and there's a lot of wildlife killed for it. A lot of people don't realise the large scale of animals that are killed for the food we eat. And for myself, coming up with Wildlife Safe Certification Label, I realised that the basic problem with wildlife and why it's targeted, it all comes down to the permit system. So if we didn't have permits, then farmers and producers obviously wouldn't be able to apply to kill wildlife, or there would be no need. I guess I just wanted to take out, just backing up a bit, I want to take out the need for producers and farmers to kill wildlife. How do we do that? That's a $60 million question. So over the years, I've spoken to many farmers and many producers, and many of them have said to me over the time, "Oh, Fiona, that's just what you've got to do. You've got to shoot kangaroos. You know, I do it. My dad did it, and his dad did it before him. It's just what you've got to do, Fiona. That's just how you run a farm." Okay, fine. So it's not about whether there's a problem or not. These are instances where this is perceived and learnt. That's how we manage farms, whether there's a problem or not. I've talked to many farmers who don't have a problem with wildlife on their farms, and farmers who do grow produce and wheat and crops without killing wildlife. So there seem to be a mixture of producers who some killed and some don't, probably more kill than don't. So there's no point in me having a discussion with a farmer about not killing wildlife if they do, because I'm not a farmer and they're not going to listen to me, and why would they? So yet if we created a platform that raised awareness of the amount of wildlife that was killed for our food and drink, and we put the consumers as deciding how they wanted their food and beverages, what went into that so that they could consume it, we put the consumers out there as being the drivers of it. And so hopefully then that producers and farmers will change their ways, because that's what consumers want. And look, over the years there's an absolute growing trend in people who, spending their money on goods and services, are prepared to pay a little bit more or want something more out of that. People are also very conscious about how their food is grown, what goes into it, whether it's got chemicals, whether it's organic, biodynamic. You look at the free-range chicken egg campaign, which was a great campaign. I mean, it showed people what nobody knew, was that chickens lived on an A4-sized sheet of paper their whole lives to produce eggs. And so they used the platform in creating the awareness and then got the consumers to buy to create the change. Now, Wildlife Safe trademark certification, it's not a new idea. It's just a different application. I mean, you've got Dolphin Safe. You've also got the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise, which is an international organisation. They cover the predator-friendly certification mark, which is active in America, because there's a lot more predators on farms and ranches over there than we would have in Australia, for instance. So you have the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise, as I said, that's international and covers America, but probably not quite in the same way that we're doing with Wildlife Safe, which is concentrating completely on how food is grown.
Go ahead.
No, you go, Derek.
So this would be the equivalent of it's always bothered me quite a lot that there are hundreds of thousands of or millions of blackbirds killed every year in the United States to make bird seed, because the birds, the blackbirds will eat it. Mm. And so If we applied the same thing here, what you'd be saying is that I could buy bird seed that was certified wildlife safe, if this were happening in the United States. Mm. This is what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's right. And if you apply that, well, like hay, for instance, is a big one in Australia, and it costs, I don't know about in America, but a lot of kangaroos, for instance, are destroyed or killed just so somebody can get a paddock of hay so they can bale all the grass and sell the hay. So it comes down to a small – so that can just be fed to stock. So, in stock supplies and a lot of other animal supplies, it's really important. And we cover a lot of those too, Derek. Unfortunately – I guess we can't cover everything, so we're concentrating more on native wildlife or animals that are native to Australia and not exotic species, because they're doing it tougher. And I guess down the track we might get some criticism for that, but I'm happy to support anybody who wants to start a certification label that might cover all those other animals. But unfortunately in this country, all the exotic animals that have been brought here over the years put a tremendous amount of pressure on what's left of the land for our native wildlife. So I guess that's why we've concentrated more on trying to help them.
Well, you and I agree on many things, but this is fine that we may actually disagree a little bit on that, that I actually don't have a problem with that, my primary concern would be for the native wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Well, mine is, but it's always the criticism, and it's always very difficult. It's like in the past we've had, say, a campaign on to save a group of kangaroos in a government reserve or somewhere, and we know there's a very bad rabbit population, for instance. We had a few years ago, we were fighting to save a mob of kangaroos in a bandicoot enclosure. Now, the bandicoots were introduced into this area, and the kangaroos were being killed because they supposedly threatened the bandicoots. Yet there were so many rabbits in that enclosure, which the ranger himself pointed out to us one day. He even said, look, you can see them all running. Look, there's another one. It was the daytime. And as he said, you never see that many rabbits in the daytime unless there's a lot of them. So he said, that proves it's a lot of them. And so then you try to say, well, can you try reducing the rabbit population to see how that helps with the bandicoots? And controlling rabbit population is a lot harder than shooting kangaroos. So it really becomes about a box to tick. Rabbits too hard, cross that box out. We'll just say we tried, but really kangaroos killed, shot, we'll tick that box, job's done, even though it doesn't make any difference. And it hasn't for years, as was exposed in the bandicoot enclosure. But then we kept them from killing them for 4 years, and then they lied to us in the end over a six-month period, lied to the media as well, and said they were doing fox control and rabbit control and wiped the kangaroo population out. And, so it's always very difficult, to get the balance right. It's also very difficult having volunteers, which some people, volunteers don't agree that the rabbits should be killed. Can't we save everything? And that becomes, it becomes very difficult. But when you're working under the banner of the Australian Society for Kangaroos, in those instances, that's what we're concentrating on. But so, yes, Derek, it's a big mess.
So another question I have, and I hope you take this in the right spirit, is that a lot of certification programs are frankly crap and are frankly greenwashing. And I have I know you, and I have so much respect for your work and for you. And so I feel like I can ask you this question, that what safeguards – okay, do you agree with me that a lot of these certification programs end up being kind of crap?
Oh, Derek, absolutely, and it was something I wanted to bring up, and I'm glad that you've brought it up. And it was something that in my research – I started looking into this about 5 years ago. It's been a very long journey to get to this point of just launching it now. And there was a lot of criticism of certification labels in what I found. And like Dolphin Safe, for instance, there's huge criticisms against that. But that's also really certified under a government body. There doesn't seem to be a lot of third-party interaction with the Dolphin Safe label. And I've also read quite a bit of material talking about the success of certification labels and how we actually measure that success. Because if I do anything, I don't want to just do anything for the sake of doing it. I actually want it to save wildlife. That's really my main aim. And out of, I said, everything that I've got to up to this point, I really think that this is the only way. So in looking at all this material and being aware of that, And one of the material I read was talking about how certification labels measure their success. And a lot of certification labels measure their success basically on their terms of reach, saying, oh, well, we have 200 producers on board, so we're having a reach out there in the community, so that means it's successful. But that's not enough, and that's a criticism, and I would criticise that, because the reach is only saying how many people would buy it. It's like Wildlife Safe. I know a lot of people out there and consumers would buy the product. It's actually getting the producers and the farmers on board, because they actually have to, a lot of them will have to really change the way that they've farmed for the last 200 years in this country. That's going to be the long road ahead. So policing it or a certification label is always going to be difficult. I guess in Australia I'm lucky. I have a very large network of wildlife people right across the country. So it's highly likely that we'll hear of something that is untoward. we would also like to be able to do a lot of spot checks on these farms and producers of what they're doing. The application is very rigorous, and if they do get caught out, it's pretty bad for them. So hopefully with that in mind, that will ward off any wrongdoing. And all certification labels, like say or the organic certification label, has a 7-year period before you can become organic. Choose cruelty-free is 5 years. We've got a 3-year period where they can change over. And it's really important to do this because you don't want someone who's just going to want to jump on a bandwagon and say, oh, look, I won't shoot anymore, I'll drop my gun, I want to get on this because I know consumers might buy my product. But we really want people to have a true transition into being wildlife safe. There's no point for them rushing into it and then a year down the track or 2 years we might hit a bit of a drought and then they just want to pull out the gun and shoot everything because they haven't really put things into place. So because of that, I also put a lot of thinking into how we would look at farmers and producers in transitioning. As I said, I know there are a number of producers out there who don't kill, but they're probably a minority. So I wanted to offer a mentorship from farmers and producers who are already wildlife safe, who could actually teach and educate and act as a mentor to people who were transitioning, which is really important because I could see myself having a conversation down the track with Joe Blow, the farmer, ringing me up from Western Victoria and saying, oh, Fiona, you know, it's never going to work. You're dreaming. You have to kill parrots and you have to kill kangaroos. And I would like to be able to say to this person, well, it's interesting that you said that because we actually have a producer in your area who has crops like you and he is actually wildlife safe. Would you like to talk to him and perhaps he could help you transition rather than me tell him because I'm not a farmer, so it's not going to do anything. So this mentorship and education program is actually integral and it's really grown over the last 5 years. And I feel that this is a very strong point for our certification label, and within that people will need to implement some non-lethal deterrents, like in the last interview I did with you, Derek, and we were talking about the Corellas and the Kilmore golf course, and we were encouraging them to purchase and implement a device called an Eagle Eye, which is it uses light and it spins, and it's been used very successfully on other golf courses to deter large Corella populations. They're harmless. So we would like to slowly over time be able to purchase enough of this equipment ourselves to be able to lend out or to rent out cheaply to producers and farmers who want to change over, who might not be able to afford a large outlay if they needed non-lethal deterrents, they could try them out, see how they worked for their farm, and then when they changed over, they'd be more happy to invest in them because they knew that they would work. I see these things as being really important. I don't want there to be any obstacles for people to change over. I want to be able to pave the way for them to go, okay, I can get from A to B very easily. We also want to be able to test and trial a lot of new wildlife non-lethal deterrents that are around in the world, bring them back to Australia, try them with our Australian wildlife and add them to the list. Our government, or all the state governments here and all the wildlife departments, I mean, they always say, always, Derek, to the media, we've issued this permit because all non-lethal methods have been exhausted and this is the last resort. I've heard it a million times and so have all other Australians. Now, this is a complete furphy or a lie because they have not tried or exhausted non-lethal methods. They've probably tried no non-lethal methods. And if I was to ask that wildlife officer or anybody in the state government environmental department, when was the last time they had a training day in non-lethal methods for wildlife, their jaws would probably drop open and they'd look at me going, what does that mean or what do you mean by that? they'd have no idea. Any organisation or government department, if they push something, I thought it was usually quite normal practice that they have training days in all sorts of things to improve their organisation. But it seems government wildlife departments don't, and you know all about that too, Derek. So, and we've been pushing all these government departments to implement, and we've been pushing them to really trial non-lethal methods and get farmers to use them, get golf courses to use them. And it's really, really difficult. After 4 years, we finally got the Victorian state government to purchase 4 Eagle Eye devices to use at some golf courses to see if they work. And then because I'm so cynical, my first thought is, oh, they're going to probably do everything they can to see that that fails. And it's highly likely that they could do that, because really at the end of the day, Derek, it's so much easier to keep the system the way it is. Let's just sign off the permit, let the person shoot them. All this other stuff's way, way too hard. It's too hard basket, and they really don't like it. So I've worked out now that I actually don't want the government to have anything to do with non-lethal methods anymore, because I do fear that they will fail them. So I want Wildlife Safe to be a kind of main organisation in Australia that does know about all the non-lethal deterrents and methods that will work, and that they will come to us for the research, and that we can trial and research them under Wildlife Safe. That's really, really important, because I know that a number of them are effective, and I know there's a lot more out there that we need to trial and use. We don't need to kill wildlife for the food and drinks that we consume every day. I don't want to sit when I'm eating my porridge in the morning and wonder how many joeys have been bashed over the head for it and how many cockatoos have been shot or gassed and stuck in a 4-gallon drum. I'd actually like to be able to eat some food and not think about all the death that's got to before I eat it. I know that's pretty gloomy, but that's realistic.
So I'm going to give 3 different examples of what are considered threats to agriculture in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they talk, you know, people who run cattle, especially on public lands in the American West, love to talk about how wolves are kill all their cows. Mm-hmm. But the actual predation by wolves is pretty small. It's very small numbers, and in any case, they are given more than market value for the wolf kills. So there really is no rationale. Mm-hmm. The perceived threat from wolves is not accurate. And prairie mm-hmm. dogs are the same. That I grew up in Colorado, and a lot of ranchers and we had cows when I was a kid. And a lot of ranchers hate prairie dogs because they say that they break the legs of cows. It's completely untrue. And
break the legs of cows?
Yeah, because the cow steps in the prairie dog.
Oh, down the hole, yeah.
Cows aren't stupid, you know? So that also is a false one. And then but I'm not suggesting they're all false. That the third one I want to mention is like boll weevils, you know, for cotton. That insect actually did eat the cotton crop and was in fact a real threat to cotton. And you and I would both agree that cotton is a real threat to the land, but we'll leave that aside. Mm-hmm. So my question, the reason I bring all this up, and if you're not comfortable answering this, don't, but so are kangaroos, are corellas a real threat to golf courses? Are kangaroos a real threat to alfalfa in terms of do they eat significant amounts? Or is this I'm not saying that they need to be killed. I'm asking if they didn't do any control whatsoever, like wolves are completely overblown. Prairie dogs are no threat to cows at all. And in fact, they improve the habitat even for cows. They say they compete for grass, but it's not really true. So the point is, are these threats at least real that they need to deal with in non-lethal fashion, or are the threats overblown and excuses? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Oh, absolutely, Jake. No, it's a really good question. And I would have to say that in some circumstances they are, and in some circumstances they're not. And this is all the stuff that I've been researching, and I've noticed over the years that kangaroos might touch crops. So we're looking at, like, I've met wheat farmers who love the kangaroos, never shot a kangaroo. They contacted me because the dairy farmer next door wanted him to shoot the kangaroos, and he rang us because he didn't know what to do. Yet I'd have 10 other wheat farmers who shoot kangaroos for their wheat. So, yes, a lot of it comes down to perception. So kangaroos may at times eat the young shoots, oats, barley. But what I found in these situations, and but often it's because of due to crop placement. So it's all to do with where the crop is on their property. So if you plant a crop, a cropping crop of a cereal crop, and you put that cereal crop quite hard up adjacent to state forest or any remnant vegetation, yes, kangaroos don't live in the open, or wallabies. They live in bush, in remnant vegetation, or in the forest. And when it comes later in the day, they will venture out and they'll venture into clearings and open spaces to eat. They don't move into those open spaces really very far because they're at more risk of predators being out in the open. They've got more cover. And I know there'll be a farmer out there say, oh, no, that's wrong, Fiona, they're all out in the open. And I would say, yes, that's because there's hardly any remnant vegetation where they are, where you are. There's actually nowhere left for them to go. So what you might find in those situations that I have suggested to people is to try changing the crop around, move that crop somewhere else where it's not near native vegetation. Really, if you're planting a crop, don't plant the crop over kangaroo pathways. There's many old ancient kangaroos that go all through the bush and all over the land in Australia, and they stick to those pathways. And so what a farmer does, he comes and ploughs up the land, ploughs over their pathway, and then plants the crop and goes, oh, the kangaroos are now jumping through the crop. You just go, maybe if you'd left the pathway there, they would have gone single file down the pathway across the paddock and your crop would have been fine. So it's just these kind of things of understanding animal behaviour, planting and farming accordingly to that behaviour, and you will see some changes. So don't put the fence right up to the state forest. See if you can put it back a little bit from the state forest. And then you're going to have a farmer saying, oh, well, then I lose so many metres of cropping, I will lose from that. And then you have to kind of go, well, wouldn't it all balance out in the end? If you did that, it might lessen your damage here, so it's all going to end up being the same. If you moved it back from the forest and planted more of a native veg buffer zone, they would probably find that just as juicy as anything else. So it's actually about giving them also something to eat. We've taken away everything, and then we complain that they eat anything. I mean, kangaroos eat grass. Shock, horror, that's what they do. But Pete, but that's their criticism. Kangaroos, and they're eating the grass, and that grass is meant for stock or for hay or for humans' purposes. So that's looking at kangaroos. I don't know if I've sort of covered that properly, but so yes, in kangaroos there have been some known issues, but there are some not known issues. So it's been found that by changing crops around, and also too, I've had farmers tell me, I actually got run by a farmer a few years ago because I said in the local paper that the government handed out permits like lollies, and he wasn't very happy about that, so he rang me and he asked me to come to his property, and I said, oh, I would love to. I was just going to ask you if I could. And I asked him on the phone if he had any rabbits on his property. And he said, no. He swore black and blue that they'd not had a rabbit there for 3 years. I said, okay. So I went out one day with a friend of mine, and we met him. We had a bit of a chat. A friend of his was there, another neighbouring farmer, who interestingly wouldn't give his name. He wanted to be anonymous and went on about kangaroos killed on the road. And I said, I'm actually here to talk about this man's crops, not not kangaroos on the road. And see, this is what happens. Farmers will say, see, I shoot the kangaroos and it reduces the cars hitting them on the road. It's not their job to do that. So everything gets very blurred. So anyway, we got in the man's vehicle and we went to the paddock that he was having problems with, and we got out of his car, and I've never trodden on so much rabbit poo in my entire life. It was literally 2 to 3 inches thick down the road. My friend went for a little wander to see what else she could see, and I looked into his paddock and I saw some cows in there, and I said, are there meant to be cows in this paddock? I thought it was cropping. And he said, oh, no, I don't know how they got in there. And so we got in the truck and had to go around the paddock to try and get the cows out. And when this was in the daytime, and when we were driving around the paddock, I saw this huge hare, half with its head and body, half out of a big hole in this cropping paddock. And I pointed to it and I said, it's a rather large bunny there. And by this stage, I was kind of feeling sorry for him, to be truthful, Derek, because there were so many other things going on in this paddock. It was quite evident that the damage to the crop, and it was a legume crop, which kangaroos are not normally attracted to a legume crop. It probably could have been more likely a wallaby or hares and rabbits. So, look, to cut a long story short, we had a look at that. I did start to feel sorry for him. We sat in the car and talked for ages, and he tried to tell me how much he loved his cows and his animals and he hated animal cruelty. And I asked him if he knew what happened to the joeys when they killed a female kangaroo, and he said he didn't know. So I told him that when the mother is shot, they pull the joey out of the pouch. They may rip its mouth and break its jaw from the teeth, from the mother's teeth. And they will just whack that joey over the bull bar of the vehicle or smash it against a tree or stomp on its head. And he didn't know that, and he seriously was shocked. I'll just say also that he'd never applied for a permit before, this farmer. He'd been farming for 20 years and had never applied for one, and I think it was a bit of pressure from his neighbours that had maybe had also contributed to this, or so I thought at the time. So I said to him, what's changed for you? I said, in the 20 years that you've been farming, obviously your costs are more, your seed is more, your fuel is more, your rates are more, everything costs you more, but are you making any more from your farm than you did 20 years ago? And he just looked at me and he said, no. And I said, so do you feel that you want to, that you've just got a permit now when you've never had one before because you think that it may make a difference and that you may be able to produce more from your farm? Is that what you think? And he said, yes, that's it. He said, that's what I think. If I kill the kangaroos, I might make more from my farm. And then we chatted a little bit more and he just looked quite sad, actually. I actually felt sorry for him in a way. And then when I went, I thanked him for the discussion and for having a look at his property. And he just looked at me and he shook my hand and he said, Fiona, he said, next time the shooters come, I'll get them to look after the bunnies first. And I just said, thank you, and left. And it was one of the most interesting conversations I've actually had with a farmer, because he was clearly torn between, he didn't want to kill, but he felt pressured to kill, and his neighbours killed, but he clearly had some issues with it. And wanted to do the right thing. So the point is, over all these years, talking to a number of producers, you realise that there are some problems, but there's also a lot behind it, like you brought up, prairie dogs and wolves. The perceived damage is really difficult to put a figure on. I'll read figures like kangaroo damage causes Australian farmers $200 million, and then I'll read another article a couple of weeks later and we'll go, rabbits cause farmers $200 million worth of damage, and then I'll read another one that says, well, pigs cause farmers $200 million. It always seems to be $200 million worth of damage, and I think, gee, with the pigs and the kangaroos and the rabbits, that's already $800 million damage. Why do they keep putting a separate figure on each one? A lot of farmers don't really know what may be causing the damage, and this is a really big problem. So what a farmer might do is they look out their backyard, they go in for dinner, maybe late afternoon, 5 o'clock, 5:30, they see the kangaroos on the hill or whatever starting to move down. They come out the next morning and they see damage and go, oh, those bloody kangaroos, look what they've done. But while they were inside eating their tea and the feed up watching television, they didn't see the kangaroos move off and the deer come in or the rabbits and the hares. They weren't watching what was going on in their paddocks the whole night, and they will just go with what they saw. And in the story that I just told, it was quite evident that this farmer was convinced that there were no rabbits on the property because they'd all been killed 3 years ago. So because he believed they'd all been killed, he actually didn't see how many rabbits and hares were on his property currently, causing a lot of damage. So it comes down to perception again. So with cockatoos, sorry, just to answer your question, the whole question, Derek, the damage from cockatoos. Yes, cockatoos like to go onto golf links and they like to dig up the ground. All cockatoos and corellas, you'll often see them, wide mobs of them, large groups of them, in paddocks or by the side of the road picking at the grass. There's a lot of little roots and tubers and things that they, onion weed and things that they like to eat that are in the ground. And also because in this country we've pretty much wiped out all the native grasses and native seeds, and it's been replaced with exotic, which all seeds at one time or also get slashed, so there's no seed left. So our parrots are very hungry. But there's a lot of things you can do on golf courses to deter corellas from doing that. There's also a lot of work being done in decoy stations for parrots that has been very, very successful on farms and golf courses. So you actually make them an alternative food station. I just think it's just so sad that we've taken everything away from our wildlife. We've taken their homes, their habitat, their food, and we're still complaining. We need to be able to help provide something. We need to be able to create more of a balance and not just kill so much. We need to be able to look at what damage is being caused by what animal, and there's a lot of work being done with little cameras to actually see what's going on in people's paddocks, and we would like to encourage people with Wildlife Safe to do the same thing so that we can actually work out what species is doing what, and then we can apply the right non-lethal deterrent to help that. So netting itself can do a lot. A lot of large orchards are completely netted, and that is really good. Parrots and birds don't like to go too far under netting, so that's a very good non-lethal deterrent.
So I have, you said something earlier that I want to come back to because I didn't quite understand it. You said that a lot of the certification programs require one to have participated for 7 years. And Wildlife Safe is – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, so I was just going to say, no, to get the certification. So if you want to be or have – if you've got a farm and you want to be organic, there's a lot of soil testing that has to go on, and they have to – usually it's about a seven-year – up to a seven-year wait
before right.
The farm can be changed to be organic. The Choose Cruelty-Free, which is mainly covers cosmetics and things like that, is often a five-year transition. So I just mentioned it in terms of becoming certified isn't something that you can do overnight. You know, mm-hmm. it does need to be rigorous, because to go back, I think, to your earlier question about how do we – about trusting certification labels and about public assurance, which is very important to me and to for this label to actually do what it says that it does. And so I would like, for instance, we're pre-launch at the moment. We're having a big launch in August, and we're starting in the wine sector, and we're only starting in Victoria because of the coronavirus and the restrictions. We can't travel around. Our borders have been blocked. So we're just concentrating on the wine industry in Victoria first, and then we'll move on to cereal crops and orchards and all sorts of other things. It's so huge that we need to probably go in steps at a time.
My point is that if you're launching it now, does that mean that no one will be able to buy Wildlife Safe wine for 5 years? I mean, so you're did you, I mean, if it takes that long, how long does it take to certify? So when will the public, so how do you launch something that's going to take 5 years or many years to certify? How does this work?
Yeah, sorry, Derek, I might not have made that clear. I guess what in the wine sector, which I was just going to explain, the wine sector is a very diverse sector. So you've got probably a lot more people in the wine sector that actually probably are not killing wildlife at the moment. So that's why we're also choosing that sector first. So you've got a diversity of animals targeted and you've got a diversity of people running wineries. But I also know there's a lot of wineries that do not and have probably never shot any wildlife for their wine. So they're the people we'll be talking to first. Now, they will have to prove that they haven't killed any wildlife in the last 3 years, and there's quite rigorous means that we have to be able to find out that information. And if that comes through, then they will be certified.
But so it's retroactive.
Sorry?
So it's retroactive.
Correct, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah. Sorry, I should have explained that probably more in the beginning. So yes, so by the end of August, hopefully we will have some, and between August and the end of the year, that we will have hopefully wine starting to come through that will have the wildlife safe certification label on it. And once we get through past August and the restrictions. We've just had suburbs locked down again here in Victoria, Derek. So it's, you know, this is the second wave happening. So it's very hard to sort of make plans ahead for particularly travel, which we will need to do to check on properties. So hopefully, yes, we will have some wine, and then we'll move on to orchards and nuts. You've got a lot of nut milks around now, almond milk, soy milk, macadamia. Nuts are very big in Australia, as I think there's big almond orchards, possibly in America as well. So we'll be looking at those and just moving forward over each sector. But I hope I explained enough before about your question about the criticisms of
no, it's great.
Certification labels, because it's something that, yes, Derek, as I said, it's always concerned me. And I guess when I was reading this material about the success and how do we measure the success of certification labels, and that many only measure their success on their reach, so meaning we have 200 or 500 producers on board, so we're successful. We don't know if it's actually making a difference, but we've got lots of people on board. So when I was reading about that, and I didn't want that to necessarily be what our label is about, and it also talked about labels that added an educational factor aside from just a reach, and then I realised that our whole, the other whole aspect of wildlife safe, which is about the mentorship, about trialling and researching new non-lethal deterrents and non-lethal methods, that is a big part of wildlife safe. And judging by what the material I was reading was saying, was that this is actually really and makes a certification label very robust and strong if it's not just relying on reach. So that was good to read, to know that we'd already included something in our certification label that that actually added more body to it. And it wasn't just about, oh, we're just going to see how many people we can get on board. I also want to say that when we start off with wineries, my first thing I want to do is actually start to see how we can measure this right from the get-go. We're going to have a few different species. So let's see straight away how we can start measuring the success. And I want to be able to keep putting this out, to be able to say we have so many wineries now or so many producers that have not killed wildlife. This is what they might have killed in the past, or the equivalent of this would have killed this much. So really, know that they can trust and have an assurance that if something is under the Wildlife Safe trademark certification, that you can guarantee that it will be. And as long as I have anything to do with it, Derek, people can be assured that it will. Because that's ultimately the most important. You know, I've worked so long like many, many people out there as a volunteer trying to save wildlife or trying to save wild places or the environment, anything. And when you've done it for a long time, you really want to start concentrating on what you think might work.
So we only have a couple minutes left.
Yep.
And I want to know how much work and how much money, if you don't mind, this has taken, because what if somebody wants to start their own, wants to replicate what you've done elsewhere? This seems more difficult to me than starting a straightforward campaign to protect a specific piece of ground. And so can you take like 3 minutes to walk somebody through how, if they want to do a, I'm just making something up, a turtle safe, you know, something that doesn't kill turtles for whatever product, how they would go about replicating what you've done elsewhere. How do you start?
Yeah, sure, Derek. Well, you got to start doing your research, obviously, and about the animals or animal that you want to save and how certification works and what else is out there. And then for us and what we did in Australia, we started, it's a not-for-profit organisation, so Wildlife Safe is a not-for-profit organisation, and it's also a certification trademark. To get a certification trademark and to have a logo, you have to go through Intellectual Property Australia or the equivalent in the country where you are to create a trademark logo. And because it's a certification, it has to go through a third-party body, which in this case is the ACCC, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, which is really important because if it was just a contract between a group and a producer, there's no guarantee to the public that there's a third party that can audit it or can step in to.
Well, that's one of the problems with a lot of the certifications is that, you know, the timber industry can just certify their own crap.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And look, there's people who, you know, it's like people write on products now, and people might eventually do this. This product has been made. No wildlife has been harmed in the making of this product. Like, they could write that on their label. Somebody could write this, you know, this is a cruelty-free cosmetic. But they can write anything they like on the label, but that's not a certification. That's just the company wanting to sell you something, and they're saying that. But you don't know, there's no guarantee that they do. There's no one checking that they actually don't kill wildlife or that there is no cruelty in that product. It has to have a certification label that is a third party, has a third party attachment to make that happen.
How did you get the ACCC?
It can be expensive. There is a bit of money but it's worth it.
How did you get the ACCC involved? How did you get them to get on board? How would somebody in the United States get whatever relevant organization to certify? That's really what I was getting is how do you get over that? That seems like a very daunting task to me.
Oh, it's just filling in a form. The forms can be quite daunting, but you just go to the websites and and I just looked up, Googled how do you do a certification trademark, and it said I had to get a trademark, get a logo trademarked first, and then you apply to the ACCC for the certification. Now, the certification takes nearly a year, Derek. It took over a year for that to happen. It's a very, very long process, the whole thing. It's taken 5 years from 2015 to now to be in pre-launch. I had to sit at a panel and answer questions from the ACCC over the phone. They wanted to know a lot more about me, a lot more about my background, why I could put myself in a position to do this, what was my training. So, yes, it's pretty robust, and you have to fill in a lot of forms and answer the questions that they ask you. But we finally was all stamped and approved, and that was actually done 2 years ago. And honestly, by then I was sort of so tired from everything. And a bit burnt out from a lot of my activism and campaigning, needed to take a bit of time off and come back to it with the help of an amazing woman called Lisa Palmer, who has a history with wildlife but also in the corporate sector. And she is really helping us get this off the ground in a highly professional way, which I can't thank her enough for. And the idea came from my research. I took it to my colleague, Nikki Sutterby, who I do all my kangaroo stuff with, and she helped me on the next step, filling in forms and asking the right questions and being critical of it so that we could come up with something really robust and solid. And so these two women have been an enormous help in this process, and it would not have happened without their help.
So I have two questions. Thank you for that. And I have two questions left. One of them is, so is there a web presence for this if people want to know about more about wildlife safe certification that they can find out on the internet?
Yes, absolutely, Derek. Thank you for that. Yes, they can find us on Facebook under Wildlife Safe Trademark Certification. And our website is www.wildlifesafe.org. That's the website.
And then the final question is, so if somebody wants to do this, you know, for porcupine safe forestry or, you know, whatever it is, can they contact you to find out more information about how they to get some pointers on how to do it?
Absolutely, Derek. I'd be happy to talk to anyone about it. They also need to do the check that the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network is a very large network, and they cover a lot of animals in a lot of countries, but they did not talk about Australia or cover Australian wildlife at all, which I guess we're a bit of a forgotten about country a lot of the time. But they need to make sure that there's nothing already covering it as well, because if you put a lot of work into making a trademark or even a certification and it's been covered by another organisation, it will be a waste of time. So in another country outside of Australia, the main organisation they would need to check under would be Wildlife Friendly. And as I said, they cover the predator-friendly label that is quite big in America, as I understand, or has been around since the mid-90s or early 90s. So that's to give certification to ranches and farms that don't kill wolves and any other predators for the food they produce. So that's already happening in America. I don't know. Have you heard of it, Derek? Do you see much of that around?
You know, I have not seen it, but that doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
Well, is there anything else you want to say about this before we go? And thank you for all this work.
No, I don't think so, Derek. I think that's really all I wanted to say. It's a long road ahead, and we'll just be taking it slowly and, as I said, trying to make it as robust as we possibly can so that we can measure the success and, to look out for it soon and for, just as always, for, as you say, Derek, for anybody who can just save anything wild, wild places, wild animals, just to get out there and whatever you love, do whatever you can to save it.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you, as always, for all of your I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Fiona Cork. This is Derek Gentum for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.